Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
This episode of Kitchen Club is kindly sponsored by our friends at Nemo Travel. Think of Nemo as your personal travel guru, someone you can talk to about your passions and interests, someone who'll take this on board and find unique places to stay and experiences just for you.
I am sure we are all desperate for a holiday after a very tough year on the travel front. Nemo are here to help give you something to look forward to. So whether you want to go all out and jet off to the Seychelles or plan a remote detox in the Scottish Highlands, they'll be there every step of the way, providing expert travel advice and reassurance, which we know is so, so important during these times of uncertainty. Nemo very kindly helped book mine and my husband's honeymoon to Puglia last summer, which was totally last minute. And with the rules changing constantly about where was and wasn't safe to visit, it was a total godsend to have their insider knowledge and support in booking our dream trip.
Their trips are also designed with sustainable practices, authentic experiences, and local empowerment in mind. So wherever you go, you'll feel fully immersed in the true culture of your chosen destination. To find out more about Nemo and how they can provide stress-free, caring travel, head to nemo-travel.com or visit them on Instagram at @wearenemotravel. Thanks for sponsoring us, Nemo. Happy travels!
Hello and welcome back to Kitchen Club with me, Serena Lau, and my babe of a friend, Sarah Malcolm.
Kitchen Club is the weekly podcast that brings you conversations from the kitchen table. Each week we have a brilliant new guest, a new area of expertise to get stuck into, and a new recipe which is created using our guests' three favourite ingredients.
Today's guest is the brilliant Sophie Whippy, a birth doula and founder of Nave. Sophie's work focuses on the rightful need for women to be informed and supported through all of life's important milestones. Nave aims to open up the conversation on women's health from an honest and unbiased perspective, from first period to menopause and everything in between.
I'm pretty gutted that I wasn't able to join in for this episode, if I'm honest, Serena. I had crippling period pains and I was saying to Serena, oh, I've got such bad pains. And she was saying, I'll just do the podcast. And as much as I wanted to do it, I kept thinking of Vianney Lee telling me to rest and honor my period cycle. So Serena took the reins for this one. And as I've edited it, I can assure you it is a really, really beautiful chat.
Yeah, we really missed having you there, but it was also quite nice being able to just ask every single question that I wanted and have Sophie's full attention because she is amazing. So if you guys are enjoying season four so far, we'd really love it if you could help share our podcast with your loved ones, leave us a review, maybe share on your Instagram stories which episodes you've been enjoying. It really, really helps us spread the word and we are eternally grateful to you for your support. So here is the wonderful Sophie Whippy on Kitchen Club. Oh, so welcome, Sophie. Thank you so much for joining us today. Well, joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to meet you.
We have wanted to chat to you for so long, so we're really excited to have you on. And for everybody listening, it is just me today, just Serena, because poor Sarah is not feeling very well. So it's a real first. Let's start, why don't we, with your three favourite ingredients. Can you remember what they were?
Oh my goodness. I'm like, a quick pull up my email. Hang on. I definitely said chickpeas.
Mm-hmm. Nobody ever seems to remember, so don't worry about it.
Oh my goodness. Hang on. Let me find it. Ah, chickpeas. I was there. Labneh and quinoa.
Delicious. And is there any particular reason why you love those three?
Do you know what? I think I really like carby food. and I find chickpeas kind of satiate that grounding energy. Labneh is like my favorite thing in the world. My husband makes it himself at home. When we used to live in London, we'd go to the local food market, and I remember it was owned by a Turkish family, and my husband was like, where can I buy labneh? And he just looked at him like he was crazy, and he was like, you don't buy it, you make it. Like, why would you ever buy labneh? So he's been making it himself, and he does this amazing dish with labneh, chickpeas, courgettes and mint, and it's just amazing. Mm. So labneh is a firm fave, also on toast with honey.
Yum.
And quinoa, again, because I love carbs, I like grounding foods. I could literally live off them all the time. So yeah.
Yeah, love I love brain. That. You are a girl after my own heart, because I also am obsessed with carbs. I love bread and I love pasta and I love potatoes. Yeah. And I feel like we're not meant to love carbs. I feel like...
I know.
I feel
They've
like...
They've gotten such a bad rap, haven't they?
Yes. Nobody eats carbs anymore. And actually, they're like the most delicious thing ever.
Yeah.
I saw someone post on Instagram yesterday a picture of like a big baguette and butter, and it said carbs is my love language. And I was like, oh my God, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. If I don't have a carbohydrate with my meal, I will definitely feel hungry like an hour and a half later. I'll be snacking on something else, trying to get that extra kind of fill in. So yeah, carbohydrates are a staple.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah. So your recipe that we created was, I think, maybe my favorite Kitchen Club recipe we've ever made.
How exciting. And I can't wait. I'm like, can I write it down?
We'll send you the recipe afterwards. But when it was funny, because when I was doing it, I was like, where can I buy labneh? And I was like, shit, well, no one near me sells it. I'm going to make it. And I've never made it before, which I feel like I should have done because I love cooking. But it was really fun making it. So simple. You just like mix a bit of salt with the yogurt, hang it for 24 hours.
Yeah. And it looks like... I've got some hanging in my kitchen right now, like my husband did some yesterday. And it is so simple that it's good. It's a good one.
And it looks kind of gross when it's hanging. You like hang it in a piece of muslin and it like drips into a bowl. It's really gross. But God, it's delicious.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, thank you for that. you've introduced me to a new thing, because I don't normally like yogurt, but I think that's yummy. So we made you labneh with slow roasted cherry tomatoes with pine nuts and balsamic and olive oil, and then quinoa and chickpea falafel with loads of herbs. And actually the falafel are so good with quinoa in it, because it gives it a bit more texture and a bit more crunch. So again, like, you've really converted me. I would never normally make it like that, but I love
it. Amazing. That sounds so good.
Please, can you give the listeners a little introduction to you, to Nave, the work that you do? I know you talk a lot about real talk with women's health, and I'm wondering like what that means to you and why that's an important message for you to be sharing with everybody else.
Sure. So I started Nave a couple of years ago now, but prior to that, I'd already been working as a birth doula. So birth doula, for not everyone always kind of knows what it is. So for those of you that might not understand what it is, a birth doula or a doula is a sort of an emotional support person. Some doulas work in birth, some doulas work in death, abortion, loss. And a birth doula specifically, my role in that area is to support the birthing person and their family or partner. So that might be in a very practical sense. It's often in an emotional sense. I offer them fact-based information. It's sort of another helping hand, really, in any way that you possibly could need. So I started working as a birth doula 4 or 5 years ago now. And then that kind of evolved from a hobby that I would say I just do it on the side, to actually me being quite busy and really, really seeing the need that people need support in this transition. And when I started to want to expand it from being sort of something I did on the side to actually a company, which still weirds me out, but, you know, a thing, it really, I started to really draw on all of my experiences as a woman, and also my experiences working in yoga. So myself and my husband have a yoga studio. We've had it for 9 years. And I've really grown up alongside the yoga studio, and sort of the experiences that I've had in my life have been running alongside having the studio and having an ever-expanding community of people. And what I had come to see and what I feel really strongly about is that actually as women, we move through these massive transitions in our lives, whether it be menarche and puberty or pregnancy, loss, all the way up to menopause. And there isn't actually that much support for these huge milestones that we move through. And I feel like there's a bit of a culture like, well, we get pregnant, we have the baby, we move on. Or we start our periods, we become women and we move on. You know, we've lost the ceremony, we've lost the ritual and the celebration behind these huge milestones. But not only that, that these milestones change us intrinsically from our physicality changes. Our, you know, when we become pregnant, the way that our brain responds to the world changes. So where's the support for the change that happens in between them? Not only the milestones, but the, you know, the entire journey in between. So when I, through working as a doula, as a birth doula, I started to see this disconnect in people and some medical providers, in that it's, you know, it's a very cut and dry, you come in, you have your baby, you go home, you're done. Well, hey, you've done it, you know. And actually it just felt so disconnected from life. You know, our life events don't happen in isolation to anything else. Everything is interconnected. We are all interconnected. And to try and isolate all of these events, it just doesn't work, and it leaves people massively under-supported. So when I was speaking with the company that actually helped me come up with the branding for Nave, and I was trying to explain to them, and I had this all this stuff in my head, and I was like, oh, it's like, you know, it's like a big web that catches people. That's what I see it as. It's like an ecosystem where we can support someone through any transition from all different angles. So whether that be emotional, physical, spiritual, sexual, all of this is connected, whether it's, whether we're approaching menopause, perimenopause, or whether we're having a baby, all of these things come into play. So yeah, it's kind of a massive web of support. That's how I see it, or an ecosystem. And I connect with other professionals in their relevant fields to kind of support people through that. But the reason that Real Talk, I feel, is so important is because I think we often shy away from talking about things that can feel uncomfortable. You know, referring into a birthing environment, we're given the cream on the top of the bottle. That amount of information is what we're actually given. And it's often not the whole story. And I think just being plain with our language, it doesn't mean being insensitive, but being plain with it, not dancing around things, being able to talk about labia and vulvas, and that's okay. Like, nothing, I'm not going to get struck down, you know, nothing bad's going to happen. And encouraging that openness to try and shed any shame or judgment or a feeling of taboo around our bodies and what we do with them and how they change. Through Nave, I through sort of my journey, I guess, I then started to work in sex education and trained to do sex ed with kids. And I've been working in two schools here in Ibiza, where I live, at the moment, working with kids aged 5 to 13 in different age groups. And just, you know, when we talk to them, or when I talk to them about body parts, the younger kids are like, yeah, that's what it is. you know, there's no embarrassment or shame around it. And then you speak to the older kids and they've absorbed all of this conditioning that says it's not okay to talk about our bodies. And I just think that's really sad, because then we as adults definitely carry that into our life experiences. And when we go through these massive physical changes like menopause, you know, there is still a lot of stigma around it. We don't talk about it. We don't celebrate it. And it is a celebratory time. It's moving into the next stage of life. You know, who doesn't want to become the all-knowing crone at some point in their life? So yeah, that's a really long-winded explanation, but that's where Nave is at the moment with everything.
That's awesome. And the sex ed thing is something that I've got a couple of questions for, but we'll save that till later because I think that's fascinating. The doula thing, like personally, I've been fascinated by doulas for a very long time because I feel like in the olden days, that was probably more how it was, right? Whereas these days, birth's been very medicalized. And as you say, like conversation around periods and menopause and stuff has kind of been hushed under the carpet. Like I'm sure for a lot of people, their first experience of having their period was kind of being sneakily handed a tampon and like, that's that, don't talk about it. And we chatted to last week, we had Ella Mills on the podcast and she was telling us all about her birth experiences with hypnobirthing and stuff. And I think it's really exciting that people are starting to talk about it and are starting to have those conversations rather than, you know, being embarrassed that they're having a hot flush because they're having their menopause and they don't want anyone at the party to know.
Yeah, it is. It's great that there's progress and that there's conversations around this stuff because we're all moving through it. You know, we may not have exactly the same journey, but we are all human. And if we're people that menstruate and people that have babies, then we're going to have things in common. So why can we not share that? You know?
And it's like we've been taught that a lot of that bodily stuff is gross. When it's not, it's the most natural stuff that your body could possibly do. It's just exactly. The like conditioning we've received, I guess, and the way society looks at it, that you need products to wash and you need products to hide and products to cover things up.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that though is to do with the way that I did a class. It just reminded me, I did a class at the school last week, and it was around body images and stereotypes and editing of images. And we looked at the history of how body types have changed and what was deemed desirable. And we looked at sort of the history of hair removal. And a lot of these expectations are filtered down through media. You know, they're not realistic expectations that people should be putting on their bodies or themselves, but it is what we absorb. As masses, you know. And when you said about doulaing and how that's how it kind of used to be done with birth, absolutely right. It used to be all of the women in the village or in your village would come round and they would sit in the room next door or in the corner of the room and they would just sit and chat. It was a really joy-filled environment and the women would be labouring and I think they were called gossips, and that's where the root of the word gossip comes from, because they would sit and discuss and just be there having banter, basically. you know, and then the medicalization came in, which is so fantastic. In some instances, it's absolutely necessary. But it isn't the savior, but it has completely wiped out the way of viewing birth as a natural occurrence, not a medical event. You know, birthing people aren't sick. They're not patients. They're not unwell. They're bloody powerful. But when we medicalize it, we then put them in the seat of the patient. Yeah, it's gotten a little bit squiffed, in my opinion.
Yeah. And of course, when there are problems or if, you know, it's a complicated pregnancy, then that's amazing that medicine can help with that. But I don't want to reduce laboring women to dogs, but I think about like, if you leave a pregnant dog alone, it can just have puppies on its own most of the time. It knows what it's doing. It gets on with it. And that's that.
And I think, not to compare pregnant women with dogs, but actually, you know, people do birth, in a smoother way, I guess, when they are left alone. That's why skills like hypnobirthing are so useful, because they allow the birthing person to drop into what's going on for them and not be bothered about the exterior or not as affected by the exterior.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I think I was saying to Ella last week, like, I really hope that one day I get to experience it, and because I think the whole thing is just incredible what your body can do. Being a mother yourself, has that really shaped the path that you've taken? Or do you think that women's health and supporting women has always been something that you've known is for you?
No, it definitely hasn't. It's I worked in fashion, went to fashion university, worked in fashion straight out of university for quite a few years. And then actually it was when I became pregnant, I was working at a creative agency, and it was really demanding of time. And when I became pregnant with my eldest, so this was in, I became pregnant in 2012. I just kind of, this switch just flicked, and I was like, I don't want to be in this environment when I have a baby, because it doesn't feel right. And I knew that I wouldn't be able to give my working environment the energy that I was currently giving it without compromising on my ability to be a mother. And I really, you know, I didn't want to have to do that. So I didn't know that I'd always work in women's health, but I think this journey has evolved with me becoming a mum. When I had my eldest, I was 25, so I was quite young. I was the first of all my friends. And it was an absolute, I felt like I'd been hit by a bus. Like, I had no idea what was happening to myself physically, mentally, emotionally. I was like a complete mess, a very happy mess, but a complete mess. And that really spurred me into finding out more about birth. And I did my yoga teacher training when my son was one. And myself and my husband had just opened our studio, so he was already a teacher and I was kind of the admin behind it. And then I did my TT, and then following that, a friend of ours wanted to host her pregnancy teacher training at our studio in London. So I said, well, yeah, of course, can I come along and take it? Because why not? You know, it'd be really interesting. And she was actually, or she is, a doula. And I learned about a doula in that pregnancy training. And I was like, oh my God, this is what I needed when I was pregnant. I needed someone to guide me and be there for me and help me in a way that that at the time my partner couldn't. It was his first time as well. He also felt like he'd been hit by a bus, I'm sure. And the medical world didn't allow for the support or information actually that I needed. And I didn't know that it even existed. So in hindsight, I was like, my goodness, that's exactly what I needed. And it really, I was like, I need to do this. So I just started to feel so strongly that actually this is something that people need. And when you have a baby, you have so many decisions to make, like about their health, about everything, about their entire lives. So I started to research everything and just kind of got deeper into research around medical protocols and the way that women have been historically treated in pregnancy and birth, and how that shifts culturally depending on where you are, and just started doing loads of research. And then when I became a doula and I started working with women, it evolves because you see firsthand where people have been dropped or where that support has dropped for them, and you start to kind of see this web where the holes are. Like, okay, this is what this person needed. Well, why did they have that approach? And I'm really interested in, I guess, psychology and our conditioning and how that affects us. And I've started training in a facilitation called Imago therapy. And all of this just kind of webbed together, I think, from my life experiences of just working with people and seeing where the gaps are and also where I've needed support. You know, where did I feel that I wasn't being held and what was missing, and why did I feel when I was younger that I couldn't ask questions to my care provider, you know, and just starting to sort of put the dots together, and here I am today. And I'm sure I'll keep going, to be honest. There's still things I'm like, oh, I want to learn about this. I want to know that. And oh, what about that? You know, and I think that NAVE will evolve with me as I get older and grow.
And I'm sure that different people need different kinds of support as they go through their pregnancy and their labor and postpartum. Is there a pattern that you see of like what it is that people need the most?
I think what people fundamentally need the most is to feel heard.
Mm-hmm.
That I think that's the biggest thing, that actually in the birth world, people don't often feel heard. And sometimes that can be the trigger between having a traumatic or a non-traumatic birth. Language is everything. And when people are told that they have to do something, or we're going to do this to you, or you need to do that, it takes away someone's autonomy. It takes away their power. So I think, you know, the biggest thing that actually a doula can do is to provide that space for someone to be heard and to be able to empathize with how they're feeling. Doesn't mean that they shouldn't take a medical recommendation, or, you know, that it has to go any which way. But the fact is that when someone is heard and given the space to come to a conclusion that they're happy with, that is the tipping point, or can be the tipping point, between a traumatic experience and not having one.
So I suppose then often you find yourself being the mediator between the medical team and the couple, or the woman giving birth.
Very often. I think it's having, obviously a doula provides continuity of care as well. So I will work with people throughout their pregnancy or whatever time they engage with me. And we'll have regular contact until after they've had their baby. Whereas in most scenarios, if you are going into a hospital or even having a home birth, you may not have met the midwives or obstetricians, definitely not the obstetricians, but you may not have met the care providers that are there for you. So it gives a doula the opportunity to form that relationship. And it gives me the opportunity to see the dynamic between the birthing person and her partner. That's really important, because I know what each of their needs are. I can see when one of them needs to be supported or when the other one needs to step out. It's being able to read that relationship. But it also gives me the opportunity to know how they've come to the point that they're in, whether they've had previous loss, whether they've had previous trauma, whether they've had a traumatic birth or sexual trauma from when they're younger, whether they're just terrified of being in medical environments, or whether actually a medical environment makes them feel really safe. You know, I get to be privy to all of this backlog of information and form a relationship with people that a lot of care providers won't have had the opportunity to do. So then they're coming in and it's another patient, you know, and that I have huge amounts of respect for midwives and obstetricians, and I have many friends who are midwives, but in a busy working environment, they don't have the same time to build that relationship that a doula does. I think that's really important. The continuity and the trust that you build helps me then navigate between the medical recommendation and my client's wishes, and how we can explore, you know, well, what are your options in this? And I can never give medical advice, and I never would, but I can be an advocate and I can help them come to a conclusion or a decision that they're happy with.
Yeah. And I'm guessing as you say, that is the most important thing, because when you're giving birth, that's like the most vulnerable you've ever been. That's also probably the most scared a lot of people have ever been. And so to be in a room full of strangers, apart from hopefully having your partner there, if you have one, is quite terrifying. So to have somebody who's been with you through the journey and who knows what you need and knows what you want and can stand up for you if you're doubting yourself or feel like you're not being heard, then that's really amazing.
Yeah, it's the most incredible thing. Like, I have yet to attend a birth, and then every time I leave, I just like have this massive cry, because it's so overwhelming, and it's so powerful to see life being brought into the world, and to witness the birthing person just in their power is just incredible. It's such a privilege to be invited into that space with people. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
And I'm sure this is different depending on which doctors, which hospital and things, but in general, how are doulas received by medical professionals? You're smiling when I say that. Does that mean it's...
To be honest, like, for the most part, I have personally been received very well.
Uh-huh.
I think there's, so again, it's a relationship, right? You've got the medical professionals, and we call them medical professionals, but they are people. you know, and this is what I say to my clients as well. They want the same outcome that we want. We're not on opposite teams. We all want the same outcome, which is a happy, healthy baby and a happy, healthy mum. And our ways of going about getting to that endpoint may be slightly different, but we're rooting in the same direction, right? But yeah, I mean, I've only ever had one circumstance where I wasn't very well received. And an obstetrician was just really, really rude to me because I'd asked a question that my client had asked and kind of been shushed away. And I was like, oh, but actually, I think she needs to understand X, Y, Z. And he was like, I'm not talking to you, you know.
Oh my goodness.
And then at one point, I got asked to leave the room. And I was, but I would like to also state that that wasn't because I was sticking my fingers in. It was because he didn't want anyone questioning what he was doing. And in my opinion, that was a real white coat sort of savior moment of, well, I'm here and I can deliver the baby, so everyone else be quiet, you know, including to my client who had a very traumatic birth. It led to trauma, and a good amount of time after that she needed to process what had happened and where the twists and turns had led her and why. But you know, 99% of the time I've always had good relationships with the medical care providers that have been present. I've gotten to know a lot of them. Obviously I've moved country now, but when I was in London, a lot of the midwives at Homerton, which was my local hospital, would know me. They'd see me sleeping on the benches and triage and waiting for clients, and you know, and they were wonderful, really supportive. And actually one obstetrician at Homerton in particular, and I remember it was just so amazing to have this relationship with someone. My client had had a very long labor, and I had been sent home for a few hours to get some sleep, and her partner was asleep on the armchair in the room, and we had a few hours of a breather, right, before anything sort of started kicking off again. And when I came back to the hospital, the obstetrician was leaving. We crossed in the hallway, and she was like, "Oh, thank God you're here. She's there. Go do your thing." And it was just like the nicest thing to receive that from someone in a position of authority, you know, and the recognition that actually a doula has value, and we have value in that space. And that was really wonderful.
Yeah, recognition was the word that was just on my mind. And I think it sounds so valuable. And I think that if I ever have a baby, I like, having spoken to you and having spoken to Ella last week, I'm like, oh my God, I want to do hypnobirthing, yeah, and I need a doula, all the support you can get. Last little question about doulaing. I'm just, what do you call it, doulaing?
I don't know. Who knows?
Like, that sounds weird.
I know. It's really odd. I don't know. Doulaing? Yeah, why not?
Doulaing. I wonder how that impacts you as a human who needs sleep, and a mother who has children who need looking after, and a husband who, or a partner who needs to have time spent with them. Yeah. How does that like fit into your life?
Yeah. So it's quite, it's really demanding. It's a really demanding role emotionally and time-wise and physically. I will not take on more than one client a month for an in-person attendance. For one client, you're on call for 4 to 5 weeks around their due date, mm-hmm, which means that in that time frame, I have to be able to drop everything and reach that person when they go into labor. So with two kids, that's quite a juggle, especially because my husband travels a lot with work, or has historically traveled a lot with work. Yeah, it's really demanding. My husband's amazing. He, you know, we kind of work together. If he's got to travel, then I know that I can't take on a client, or I can take on a client and make it very clear that for this week, I can't be available, but my backup can be. So if that's the case, I'll always try and partner with another doula. So they would be my backup if for anything, you know, any reason I couldn't be there. With the kids, it's quite tricky. My youngest is 2.5, he's coming up to 3. And I started doulaing again. I think I took a little bit of time off to have him. I attended a handful of births whilst I was pregnant, which was really cool actually to be in a similar sort of space. And then I took a bit of time off, I think 10 months once he was born, and then I started doulaing again. And I, you know, some labors I've been at, I've been back and forth for 3 or 4 days. It's pretty intense with your time, but he's actually been fine. My husband's really swooped in, and I remember one birth, my mum came up because my husband had to work. So my mum traveled up. It really does, you know, the saying, it takes a village to have a child. is absolutely true. Probably takes two villages to have enough support. But to be a doula, a working doula with children, also takes a village. I've had really close friends in London. I've had them on call for me. So when my husband's been traveling and I've said, look, I've got a client, if she goes into labor, can I call you in the middle of the night? Will you come and get into bed with my baby? Because I'm going to need to go to the birth. And you know, I'm really lucky that I've got that support network, or I had that support network in London. I'm building it slowly here. But yeah, it takes a village. It takes a village to be a doula, and it takes two villages to be a parent.
So you basically always have to be with your phone on, well slept, make sure you've eaten something in case you're about to go to the hospital for 8 hours.
Yeah. So I pack a birth bag. I have my, you know, a client packs their birth bag. I pack my birth bag. It's got a spare charger. It's got some essential oils. It's got a hot water bottle. It's got a birth ball, a yoga mat, snacks, water, all of the stuff that I might need to be at a birth for 36 hours or, you know. And then sleep wise, I'm actually really lucky. I can literally sleep anywhere at the drop of a hat. So I've slept on hospital benches, I've slept on hospital chairs, you know, caught up wherever I can in little bits and bobs. But that's also where, you know, if you're attending a birth and there's a birth partner as well, you're a team. The three of you are working together. And when the partner may need sleep, I can kick in. If I need a few hours sleep, they can kick in. And it's that, it's the same saying as, you know, when you become a parent, you can't pour from an empty cup. So yeah, if I'm on call for a birth, it's early night, no alcohol, good food, make sure that I'm not maxing myself out at any given day so that I have the energy if and when I'm called, and having a bit of backup and support on call for me as well. It's quite a big ordeal, isn't it? Now I'm missing out. I'm like, oh, that's quite a lot.
You must be like the most prepared woman ever, but it's incredible. I don't know many people who could do that, I don't think. So I it's very impressive, I think, to have the capacity to look after your family and then to be there for the women you're working with. And it's a lot.
Yeah, and it is. And it can feel like sometimes it's a juggle, but the reward of being there and seeing that person birth their baby is more than worth it. And then afterwards, I always go home, have a chocolate bar and get into bed.
I saw you share something on Instagram the other day, and I can't remember the wording, but you had been to a sex ed class at school and some of the kids had asked you some questions, which were kind of sweet and kind of funny, but also quite shocking that they didn't know the answers. And I can't think of any examples, so I don't want to guess them.
Some of the things that they come out with is shocking and sometimes hilarious and really sweet.
Yeah, I remember thinking some of them were funny and some of them I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
So I think I know the answer to this question, but presumably you're not a fan of like pee-pee and nunu as names for vaginas and willies. And I just did it myself. I just said willies. Yeah. It's so ingrained, isn't it? Sorry, penises.
Penises. It is. No, I'm not. And the reason I'm not is because 1 in 4 children will be sexually abused when they are grown up. And if a child, if we unconsciously are saying to a child, well, you can't call it a penis, it's your willy, right? It's this childlike friendly term that we don't talk about, and no, you can't touch it, and no, we can't see it, and it's secretive, right? Mm-hmm. If they are then put in a compromising position where someone is taking that same tact of like, this is our secret, we don't tell anyone, it's just a willy, blah blah blah, how are they then supposed to know what is right or wrong? You know, children are so often told, you're okay, don't worry, you know, if a child's crying, you're fine, up you get. That's minimizing their response. It's minimizing their feeling. And then we take away the power of language and being able to correctly name their anatomy. And we minimize their feelings when they hurt themselves or when they're upset or, I don't know, I'm trying to think of all the examples with my son. He's in a real tantrumy age at the moment. And it's that constant negotiation between I understand, I empathize, that you're feeling very frustrated, but I also need you to get in the car because we need to go to school. so, you know, but children don't have a lot of power, right? They don't get to make that many decisions for themselves. They are kind of their life is laid out day to day by their care providers. And to give children power, to give them their own power and to be able to give them their own language and to validate their feelings and validate their intuition about things is the biggest gift we can give them. And it's also a huge safeguarding tool for them. And it, you know, it's been proven in other countries. I just wrote an article for Inc. magazine, Inc. publication about my article is called Do You Nunu, actually. So it's funny that you said Nunu.
Because I'd written the question and then I saw the article on your Instagram and I was like, shit, there we go. There's my answer.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's especially in Nordic countries, they're taught the correct language of their anatomy. And you then see that down the line in lower rates of sexual abuse, lower rates of abortion, lower rates of sexual assault as adults. Wow. And I'm not saying it's down to that singular thing, but it's an approach that we have to our to the education that we give young people. I don't want my children growing up feeling ashamed of their bodies or that they can't communicate to their parents about how they're feeling or what they're going through. And I think, yeah, you know, I always think of it as if we want to see less people having traumatic births or less sexual assault rates, less, abuse and trauma on all people, but especially minorities, then that starts with children. How do we educate them from the best of our ability to move forward in their life with those tools?
That's it's so starts. Interesting. I've never looked at it that way. I've never really thought about it like that, because at a glance, calling it your fanny feels very sweet and inoffensive and unproblematic. So I can't believe that I did it to you and said Willie, but there we go.
No, not at all. Like, I still do it, you know. I still, my littlest at the moment, he's in a real phase of playing with his willy, because all little boys do. And I say, you know, I just did, like, you're playing with your willy and what are you doing? Blah, 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 blah. But especially with the older kids that I'm teaching, it's all anatomically correct terms. And I do, you know, my littlest knows that it's called a penis as well. He can say both and stuff. And yeah, it's just really important. I really think it is. And a lot of parents aren't comfortable with it. And that comes down to their own discomfort with sexuality, in my opinion, not to upset anyone, but to me, that's where the root of that discomfort is. But it is, it's a powerful gift that we can give our children to be able to advocate for themselves as they grow up in the world.
And hopefully by teaching our children that, we're also giving ourselves the opportunity to, like, decondition some of the stuff we've learned about sex and our bodies and the way we feel about our sexuality.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm, you know, I don't think anyone is, like, completely broken free of the conditioning, but I think a lot of sex educators, especially, you know, I think a lot of their work is when, as they move through it themselves, these are how these things come to light, right? That's how these conversations are started, because of someone's experience.
Have you read Come As You Are by Emily Nagoski?
No.
Oh my God. I've just finished it and it's amazing. It's fascinating. She's awesome. And it's all about, like, I don't want to use sciencey words so people don't know what I'm talking about, but basically, like, the things we've been taught about sexuality and how that affects our sex lives and how it affects the way we relate to our sexual partners. And it's just brilliant. It's so good.
That does sound amazing. I'm going to have to write that down.
Yeah, let me know what you think when you've read it. I wish that we had more time to talk about sex education, but I know you have got to go. So just final question.
Yeah.
Do you remember what your healthy habit was?
I do, because I backtracked on it. I remember emailing you and then I was like, no. So since we moved to Ibiza last year, I've been swimming in the sea every day, and I've actually sort of, it dropped off a little bit weirdly as the weather's gotten warmer, but all through the winter I was getting in the sea every day, and that completely kept me grounded and sane. It's like medicine. It's, you know, you go into cold water, you come out completely cleansed. It's like, okay, clear vision. So yeah, sea swimming or cold water, actually. The pool, our pool is now colder than the sea. So that's my go-to at the moment. But yeah, sea swimming. And then I remember my first email to you was sort of trying to take care of myself with two kids and working and a working husband. I read it back and it just sounded so sad, but it is true that kind of taking care of myself, making sure that I have nice products. It sounds so basic, but taking the time, I know if any mums are listening, you're going to totally get this, but to everyone else, it might just sound a bit desperate. but taking the time to like wash and cleanse my face and put a nice moisturizer on, or once a week putting a mask on, or using retinol to try and get rid of all my lines, or, you know, anything.
You don't have any lines.
Oh, I do.
You've got beautiful skin.
I've got two kids. I barely slept in 8 years. Definitely got some lines.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, little things like that, taking the time to look after myself. Sometimes that's having 15 minutes in the bathroom by myself with the door closed and no child in there, like heaven. Sometimes it's having a cup of coffee in the sunshine at the weekend and not sort of rushing out of the door to get everyone up and dressed and to school and all of that, you know. But if not, sea swim. Sea swim cures all.
Yeah, completely. I went for a cold water swim this morning just before this. That's why I've got wet hair. So I love it. Brockwell Lido.
Lovely.
It's my weekly treat and I'm obsessed. But I literally love you. Carbs, self-care, and cold water swimming. Like, yes. Those are my favorite things.
Am I a cliche?
No, you're not.
I guess
you're
carbs, like, aren't, so that's fine.
You're like my dream best friend. It's not a cliche at all. I just need to move to Ibiza and then I'll be happy.
Ibiza's great. It's very welcoming.
Thank you so, so much for your time today. I know Sarah is going to be so gutted not to have been here and met you and chatted to you, but I really can't thank you enough.
Well, it's my total pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's really lovely chatting to you.
I am gutted, Serena. I am. I was editing this episode and I wanted to butt in like I usually do and waffle on about something weird, but it was actually so, so lovely to just be a listening participant on that episode. I thought Sophie was so wonderful and so eloquent, and I also wish that she was around to teach me sex education when I was younger. And it's so, so great that it is becoming more of a nurtured subject and not just a random teacher that's forced to do it who doesn't want to do it, which was the case in my school. I don't know if yours is the same, Serena.
Completely. It's always like a random math teacher teaching you to put condoms on a banana.
I actually really wish we'd had more time to chat to Sophie about sex ed, because I feel like there was so much more there that we could have gone into. So we'll have to persuade her to come back on another time.
And Serena, well done you for doing that all by yourself. I'm very proud of you. You don't even need me now. I can just bugger off.
Thanks, babe. It must have been really weird for you listening and like not being there, being like, wait, this is my podcast. What are you doing?
But yeah, we missed you.
If you guys would like the recipe, and I'm telling you, you do, because it was a really bloody good one, then please head over to Instagram at Kitchen Club Podcast and give us a follow. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please do share the episode, subscribe, leave a comment. We are so grateful for all your help getting the word out.
We really do appreciate you all for listening. So a big, big thank you. And now I'm off to train in becoming a doula so I can be there for you, Serena, because I think that's all you want from friends now.
That makes it sound like I'm pregnant. I'm not. I am not. But yes, doula training sounds great.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.